from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Amandine Lee.
And I'm William Lawrence.
This week on War News Radio, Behind the Screens, we investigate how video games portray warfare and their impact on players' perceptions.
Then, we talk to journalist Anna Bodkin about her new book on living and eating with families in Afghanistan and countries around the world.
Finally, we take a look at the status of women in Afghanistan and how the foreign presence affects them.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
On Monday, November 8th, the Iraqi parliament is expected to meet to begin forming a new government. This will be only the second session since Iraq's national elections in March. Following a mandate of the Iraqi Supreme Court issued last month, the parliament is set to select a speaker and two deputies. It remains unclear who will serve as prime minister, though a number of sources expect current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to retain his position. Rival Ayad Alawi, whose coalition originally won the most seats in the new parliament, is now considered less likely to become prime minister after Maliki gained allies among minority factions.
51 worshippers and 7 security forces were killed and many more wounded in a raid on a Catholic church in Baghdad. Militants linked to al-Qaeda stormed the church during mass, taking about 100 people hostage. After reports of executions inside the church, the Iraqi security force tried to rescue those inside. The incident has led many Iraqi Christians to question their safety. Only about 600,000 Christians remain in the country.
On Wednesday, about 20 bombings struck Baghdad. Reports range from 63 to 113 people killed, with hundreds more wounded. The attacks targeted predominantly Shiite neighborhoods. It is unclear who perpetrated the attacks.
Afghanistan's Office of the Attorney General has launched investigations into possible fraud by the Electoral Commission during the September Afghan national elections. In addition, 200 people, including dozens of parliament members, rallied on Tuesday against flaws in the election. The Electoral Commission has thrown out close to 25% of ballots cast in the election for fraud and are investigating 220 candidates. But the Electoral Commission's impartiality is being called into question.
On Tuesday, Taliban forces attacked government headquarters in Ghazni province, southeast of Kabul. 16 police officers supposed to be defending the building are missing. It is not clear whether they were abducted or voluntarily joined the Taliban. National government forces moved in about 3 hours later and retook control of the city.
The Pentagon has been in the center of controversy after deciding to award a large jet fuel contract at a U.S. base in Kyrgyzstan to MENA Corporation. The Pentagon's decision has been criticized due to allegations of corruption between the U.S. and MENA Corporation. These allegations have been under investigation by Congress for the past 6 months, but have not been proven. Officials in the Kyrgyzstan government claim that former Kyrgyz President Bakiyev has profited from MENA's contracts with the United States. Hiring MENA Corporation risks alienating Kyrgyzstan, which is key to American military operations. All American troops that enter or leave Afghanistan go through Kyrgyzstan.
A new Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals order leaves Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the policy that bans gays and lesbians from serving openly in the military, in effect. In September, District Court Judge Virginia Phillips ruled Don't Ask, Don't Tell unconstitutional. Last month, she put a worldwide stay on the law. However, the government has appealed the ruling, and the new order allows the military to continue to enforce Don't Ask, Don't Tell while the appeals process goes on. Though the Obama administration opposes the policy, it has fought to keep the debate in the courts because the administration believes Congress, and no other branch, should have the authority to repeal the law.
Decision Points, a memoir by former President George W. Bush, is due for release on November 9th. In the book leaked to the Drudge Report last week, Bush reveals misconceptions regarding 9/11 and the lead-up to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The former president acknowledges experiencing a sickening feeling upon discovering no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He also discusses his decision not to replace Dick Cheney as vice president in 2003. This is War News Radio. 150,000 U.S. troops are currently stationed in Iraq and Afghanistan. But that number pales in comparison to another group, The mass is sitting in front of their TVs and playing video games in the role of U.S. soldiers. The makers of the especially popular Modern Warfare 2 believe that their first-person shooter game is in the hands of 25 million users. Lewis Katz took a shot at defining the effects of the experience.
War stories are nothing new, but there's a key difference between playing video games and reading The Odyssey or watching Saving Private Ryan. Miguel Sicart, a professor of game design at the University of Copenhagen, explains.
I think the fact that we play these video games and that it's a very sort of individual type of experience, very interactive, it's certainly what makes, in my opinion, video games much more effective for the portrayal of some things regarding war.
Military video games sell millions of copies and are hits with both soldiers and civilians. But as people increasingly interact with war through this lens, fears emerge that the games are sending the wrong messages to players. Professor Sicart thinks that modern games often fail to present a complete picture of combat. He worries that important ethical issues are often left out.
We have so many games about war, but in these games, the first thing we remove as developers is civilians. So suddenly you are depriving the player of making mistakes that have very serious consequences, right? Video games are terrible in portraying, in general, ethical dilemmas and ethical thinking. So the type of conflict, it's exactly the same that we find in Space Invaders.
Of course, commercial video games aren't designed to be perfect simulations. They're supposed to provide a fun experience for their players. Stefan Tsai is a student at UC Santa Cruz who plays Modern Warfare 2. He's quick to point out some of the game's inaccuracies.
In real life, I know, we're just like hunting a bunch of terrorists, so I don't think they have a significant force to like actually cause like a complete city firefight, and that, hence that's why you hear on the news is all the car bombings and everything. You never see that in this game. And I guess you can say it's a sort of unrealistic in terms that it's just chaotic fighting. Yeah, and I guess compared to real life, it's not that realistic.
Lieutenant General Mark Hertling has a special reason for caring about the way video games portray life in the military.
So I'm literally in charge of the folks who are just entering the Army.
Hertling is concerned that recruits might be getting the wrong impression of what it means to be a member of the U.S. Armed Forces.
Soldiering and the profession of arms isn't just all about killing or meeting objectives. It's also about conflict resolution. You know, we spend as much time in every war wrapping conflict up as we do actually committing violence. You know, you don't get a complete picture of in playing video games, and that's a little bit disturbing.
And the influence of these games doesn't stop once recruits enter the armed services.
I've been in Iraq for a total of 3 years over the last 8. Gaming is the highest form of relaxation. You know, everybody has an Xbox, everybody has a PlayStation.
Yet, Hertling is optimistic about the potential of video games. He believes video games can do a surprisingly good job teaching the skills necessary for combat. In fact, the Army is already taking advantage of these resources.
They are a good training tool, and they do immerse our young soldiers both prior to entering into the Army and even after they enter the Army, as we use games like America's Army 3 or Mortal Kombat. I mean, those are some of the things we also use.
But the military is beginning to see other ways games can be used for training.
The people that run our Center for the Professional Military Ethic, which is located at West Point, have just come out with a game that's a twist on Mortal Kombat. It's called Moral Kombat, and it presents ethical dilemmas to young men and women who are playing these games in a gaming environment to cause them to kind of think about the other things that are associated with conflict, not just the shooting and the killing.
Peter W. Singer is the director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution. He agrees that video games could be helpful to the Pentagon. But when it comes to civilians, he has a more fundamental concern about our collective obsession with military video games and what it says about our understanding of war.
We have this strange disconnect happening where most of the public for a nation that is actually at war really is only vicariously experiencing war through these games. And so that gives them, I think, a wrong impression of the reality of war and the challenges of the that soldiers on the ground face. We're about to have an election here. We're a nation that's at war. In no way, shape, or form is the discussion of the war one of the most important parts of that election.
For Singer, the issue isn't so much that video games are misleading us about the realities of war.
I think most people get that it's just a game. I think most people do. The problem is that they don't have sources of information to know this is what military likes. This is what the political decisions that matter. This is how I might make an informed decision on them. So we're kind of at a loss.
Professor Sicart agrees that players are pretty good at acknowledging the inaccuracies of what they're playing. But if these games aren't distorting people's perceptions of warfare, is the absence of accuracy really a problem? Sicart still thinks the answer is yes. He believes that when video games shy away from interesting moral issues, they miss a great opportunity for exploring the nature of war.
The excellent critical war computer game would teach us the virtues of war as much as the horror of war. And I think that would be an ideal takeaway, because the virtues we can take to our daily life, and then the repulsion against war as sort of an event, it's also a very important message to convey.
But games aren't necessarily moving in that direction. For Stefan Tsai, most modern games are just too one-dimensional to convey any substantial message.
To use video games as a, you know, something to change the world that significantly, I don't think that's, you know, really that viable. But to change how people think about the war, I mean, that takes a little bit more than just video games are playing through, because sometimes video games portray just senseless killing or something, and then all you just do is just want to go around and just shoot sometimes. And then sometimes that's not a really good way to get people to change their minds about war.
Whether video games come closer to depicting the complexities of combat will remain to be seen, and debates may continue over their effects on players. But for those of us who never witness war, games may be as close as we get. For War News Radio, I'm Lewis Katz.
This is War News Radio. Anna Bodkin is a journalist who has spent time living with local families in conflict regions throughout the world. Out of her many experiences, she identifies food as a factor that solidified her connection with these families. Karim Sari Ahmed interviews Bodkin about her time in Iraq and Afghanistan and her new book, Piecemeals, Candy-Wrapped Kalashnikovs, and Other War Stories.
Anna Bodkin, the freelance war reporter with whom I talked about the disillusionment of Afghan civilians back in June, believes deeply in the importance of the individual. In her first book, Piecemeals, she tells the stories of people with whom she spent her time while on assignments in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, and other conflict zones. She makes it a point to remind us that these people not only suffer, but also breathe and smile, fall in and out of love, have babies, and of greatest interest to Bodkin, they eat. I talked with her about how this humanity expresses itself.
You said one of your greatest joys was to see people reasserting their humanity with renewed force. Have you met people who kind of don't almost have lost that ability, who are defeated by their situation?
No, I don't. I mean, I think that we have an incredible desire to persevere, an amazing reflex to survive. Not just for our sake, but for the sake of our children, for the sake of our loved ones. And in the direst of circumstances, that desire still exists. You know, I definitely have seen people completely destroyed by poverty or conflict. I have seen children whose eyes are ageless, eyes of old men, who have seen life go by and know that no more is coming. But even in these children, if you get them outside, if you give them a couple of hours and a kite, they will fly that kite and they will laugh despite all the hardships that they have to face during the day and despite lack of sleep and despite maybe being sick, they, you know, they still retain that humanity.
So on that note of kind of trying to establish that connection and a relationship to people who are so far away, could you again briefly explain why you think food and the act of sharing food, of sharing a meal with somebody, is such a powerful, almost like a symptom of that humanity?
I think food is a common denominator because this is something we can all relate to. We all have to eat. We all like to sit down around a meal. And for all of us, regardless of our circumstances and regardless of where that meal takes place, whether it's at a table or at an oilcloth spread on the floor or in the back of a truck, we all consider this communal act of breaking bread together as sort of a sacred exchange that happens between us as humans. And so it is an important part of remaining human to have that exchange.
And so the people that you most often share these meals with in your travels were your translators and your drivers. Could you describe the kind of special relationship that you had with these people?
People I travel with are, they become family because it is possible that these will be the last people I see. It is possible that I will be the last person they see. So, first of all, they're extraordinarily courageous for coming with me to some of the most dangerous parts of some of the most dangerous countries in the world. You know, we develop a very, very close relationship because we survive together incredibly stressful situations, devastating situations, knowledge that is gut-wrenching. And that kind of bond that we develop, I think it stays forever. I am very close with the people who worked with me, alongside me, with whom I have been able to maintain a relationship. For example, my last trip to Afghanistan in the spring, I stayed at a family house, and we write to each other weekly and sometimes several times a week. My host father just died. He had cancer, and I called my friends at the house just to make sure that they were doing all right. It's a very close relationship. It's hard to describe because it's so intense and so temporary and so quick sometimes. Sometimes I only go to a place for, you know, a week or 2 weeks and definitely wonder whether you'll ever see them again because you go and they stay in a country that usually is a very unsafe country for civilians.
One striking story in her book comes from one of her own experiences while traveling through Afghanistan. It's called Candy-Wrapped Kalashnikovs. I asked her to retell it.
Candy-wrapped Kalashnikovs were the guns, it was actually a gun that a bodyguard I had to hire in Afghanistan in 2001 turned at me and when he tried to rob me at gunpoint. It was on a road where four Western journalists had been decapitated a few weeks before, and it was considered a dangerous road, therefore, particularly for Western journalists. It was also a road where highway robbers had waylaid travelers for centuries. So it's sort of a notoriously bad stretch of road. And I had hired a bodyguard from a local commander. We had agreed on the amount of money they were going to get paid. And when the time came to pay, I handed them the money, and they shoved the barrel of a gun at me and basically said, "More money." I started arguing with him because I was young and stupid. Since then, I learned that you actually never argue with anybody who points his gun at you. But what was extraordinary about his gun was that he had decorated it with wrappers from bubblegum and candy and dum-dums and, you know, hubba-bubba, So the barrel of the gun that was about to kill me was yellow and pink and blue, and it was screaming all these colors at me. It was unbelievable. It was very hard to believe, I mean, that he was actually going to shoot that thing at me, and he didn't, because not because of the candy wrappers, but because other gunmen showed up and basically told these gunmen to get lost and saved my life. Never argue with anybody who points a gun at you, even if that gun looks like something from a cartoon, you know, from a Disney cartoon.
Peace Meals is on bookshelves now. Go check it out. For War News Radio, I'm Karim Sari Ahmed.
This is War News Radio. According to the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, there were more than 1,500 reported cases of domestic violence in the first half of 2010. Further, women lack many basic rights: the right to go to school, to participate in government, to choose who they marry, even to leave their house to seek medical care during pregnancy. Amandine Lee brings us more on the complex reasons behind the abuse of women in Afghanistan and what needs to be done to stop it. This piece first aired in August 2010.
Problems for women in Afghanistan are widespread and varied. And, according to Wajma Foh, an Afghan journalist and activist, they have been around for a long time.
The issue that the women of Afghanistan had has not really changed. These are the issues that we had 50 years ago, like basic, very, very basic access, like access to health, access to education. Every 30 minutes one woman loses life due to very basic matters, mortality or pregnancy-related complications. And similarly, access to education has really shrunk in the past few years as the security and the Taliban insurgency has increased much more.
There is a noticeable dichotomy between the countryside and the cities in Afghanistan. Matthias Tomchak is the director of the Support Association for Women of Afghanistan, or SAWA Australia, an organization that sends money to women's NGOs in Afghanistan.
Women in Kabul, they can go to university, they can get jobs mainly with NGOs, particularly if they are computer literate and can speak English. These are the two requirements to get a job anywhere in Kabul, more or less. In the countryside, women are basically still the property of men. The economy is basically agricultural and poppy growing, of course, which is the business of the men, and the women just have to stay home and do the cooking and bear the children. They depend entirely on their husbands and other relatives, and if the husband is a nice person, then they have a reasonable life, although they are locked away from the world. And if the husband is a misogynist, then they suffer severely.
There's a huge foreign presence of troops and aid organizations in Afghanistan who support women's rights. But some consider the warlords who in practice run Afghanistan huge perpetuators of the problems that affect women. Tomchak explains how the troops may strengthen the warlords.
Millions and millions of dollars are paid to local warlords to get security for the transportation, and if they don't pay that, they get attacked. They are extreme misogynist. They don't allow girls to go to school. They support early forced marriages. And the whole story of Afghan women's suppression.
Wajma Foh, however, considers their presence necessary.
A lot of women activists and I myself, we believe that if we didn't have the international troops, we wouldn't have reached where we are today. It actually opened the whole doors for us.
However, the way that NGOs have gone about helping women has actually created a violent backlash from men who resent their efforts.
What we have been doing in the past 10 years is creating this women-only space in which men have been really blamed. There has been so much focus on women-only programs where men thought that they felt kind of deprived from those opportunities. That didn't help. That actually created a backlash. The men who are very much angry, the men who think that their opportunities are being taken by women, they have to be brought forward. forward. They have to be part of this process.
What's more, singling out women ignores the nature of gender relations in Afghanistan.
Women are not like the women of the other world, for example, who are able to make their own decisions. For example, for me, like I live in a rural family, but still, like, my father is the head of the family. I can't do anything very much against him. We are very much linked to each other. So in that way, you can't separate people.
In addition, changes in women's roles are linked to the Soviet and communist eras, when they were forced on Afghanistan.
And women in that regime, in the urban areas, for example, they became a sort of symbols of communism. And communism was very much resented against. Only Kabul, for example, was supportive, but not the provinces. So now when you have the same, for example, progress for women, when you see women wearing Western clothes, when you see women going to school, when they are working, when they become teachers, so then it brings those memories back to the local communities, thinking that, okay, maybe it's the same government, maybe it's the same approach of trying to take out these women out of home. So it is very political.
There's also the worry that new ideals are disrespecting older values.
Maybe the foreigners are here to liberate the women in a negative way. It's an Islamic traditional country with all those sort of values that they believe in. So they think those values are being challenged, those values are being kind of like mockery of these values.
That being said, there have been a lot of liberal reforms in Afghanistan since 2001. Matthias Tomczak says, however, that in practice they are not enforced.
The Afghan constitution is really only a piece of paper. If you read it, you think that it is a progressive country. The minimum age for marriage is 16, but there are still girls being married at 10 or 12 years old.
One thing that has worked, Wajmafo says, is the 27% quota for women in Afghanistan's legislature. Though democracy in Afghanistan is weak, it empowers women and gives them an opportunity for them to interact with men on the level of equals.
For example, I remember that some people came from Helmand to see a woman MP, and the man was saying that before I was even embarrassed to talk to a woman who was not part of my family, but now when I hear her talking about water, asking for power, asking for schools for my village, then I become proud of this woman. I came to create support and to create a sort of to show my support to these women.
And Fo emphasizes that the abuse of women is not entrenched in Afghanistan's culture. With the right tactics and the enforcement of the laws, it can change.
It has little to do with the tradition. I'm always against this idea. I hear in the media that it's because of our culture. It's not because of our culture. Look at India. 30, 40 years ago, India had a worse situation than Afghanistan. Women in India were going through very severe violence. But things changed because we worked with women in the grassroots. At the processes I was talking about, they did empowerment. At the same time, they involved men. And also the government became serious in implementing laws.
For War News Radio, I'm Amandine Lee. That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our website.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Aaron Moser, Rosanna Kim, Jeremy Rappaport-Stein, Kyle Crawford, Anjali Kadambi, Sam Hirschman, and Kate Aronoff. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Amandine Lee.
And I'm William Lawrence. Until next time, thanks for listening.